So it's Parshas Kisaitse. But what I want to do today is actually mainly focus on Elul and Rosh Hashanah. Because the next two, the next two Tuesdays, I'm not going to be giving this year. I'm traveling next Tuesday, Mr. Shem, for my nephew's wedding overseas, and we'll be back 9 days later. So I'm going to miss two Tuesdays, so Rabbi Levi will be on next 2 weeks. So that's it. You see, you'll be okay. But I do want to start with something on the Parsha, which is page 1046. It's Parsha's Kisaitse, which is very much connected to the idea of Elul. And the whole process of tshuva and repairing for Rosh Hashanah and so on. So if you look at page 1046, the Torah is discussing a very, very complex halacha, a very strange halacha in a way. Difficult to understand in its literal sense, but we're not going to go into that today. We have done that in the past, but it talks about going to war, and then it's the captured woman and the permission that someone, a soldier, has to be able to have relations with her and marry her, and so on and so forth. So it says, Kiseitze la melchama al oivecha, when you go out to war on your enemies, and asonai Hashem alakecha biyodecha, and Hashem will give the enemy into your hands, v'shavisa shivyo, and you'll capture people. And then it goes on to detail exactly what happens. Part of the halacha is that this woman that you capture, the yosh, it says in the next pasuk, in pasuk Yud Gimel, in verse 13, it says she will remove the garments of war, and she will sit in your house, and she will cry for her parents for a month, and so on and so forth. Which the Zohar says that this month that the pasuk is talking about over here is actually a reference to Elul, because it's a hint. In other words, it's on a deeper level, it's a month to the month of Elul, where we reflect or we make preparations to do tshuva on the coming Rosh Hashanah. But this concept of a war, the commentaries explain that it actually has a lot of deeper meanings, and the war we're talking about also has to do with the war against the Yetzer Hara. Right? We're always going out to war, we're fighting evil. And this idea becomes emphasized during the month of Elul, where we have to confront our shortcomings, confront our weaknesses, and so on. And sometimes it seems overwhelming. So we have this idea that if you look at the wording, the very, very careful wording right at the beginning of the parasha, it says, Kiseitze la milchama al oivecha, when you go out to war. So if you look in the English, it says when you go out to war against your enemies, right? Against your enemies. But the truth is that's not what it says in the pasuk, the Hebrew. If you look at the word, the word is al. Al in Hebrew doesn't mean against. Al means on top of, right? Now, contextually, obviously, that's what the pasuk is referring to when you go to war against your enemies. But the word chosen is the word al because the commentaries explain that it's an attitude that we have to have both in a physical war and in a spiritual war. That when we go out to war, yes, there is a struggle. Yes, there is a challenge to fight with. But we have to go with the confidence that we can win it. Aluvecha, we're on top. When we go out to war, we are already on top of our enemies. Right? Same thing is with the internal struggle against the Yetzer Hara. When we fight against the Yetzer Hara, we need to know that, yes, there's a struggle. There is a Yetzer Hara, and there's different temptations that we have pulling us in different directions, which we have to deal with, particularly during the month of Elul, but it's alevecha, we can do it. We have to have the confidence that we can actually win that war. So that's just a little bit of a hint to the month of Elul. But I have said this before, but I'm just going to repeat it before we go into a general concept of Rosh Hashanah, which I'm going to focus on more today. We have a paragraph in the Parsha, also a very complicated paragraph, which highlights an amazing message about return, about tshuva, about hope, that nothing is ever lost, right? And it's the parsha, it's the halacha, the law, which talks about ben soirer u'moirer, the wayward son, the rebellious son. Now, just have a look at the pasuk at the same page, 1046, verse 18 at the bottom over there, yutches. The Torah says, ki yihye le'ish ben soirer u'moirer, if a person will have a rebellious son, Einenu shomea v'koil ovi v'koil imo. He does not listen to the voice of his father, the voice of his mother. Yisroel sin will be punished, while Yishmalem, and he continues not to listen. And he just is out of control. He's stealing meat and drinking wine and all kinds of things. Sof suboy obi v'imoy, and his father and mother take him. V'hoitziyo oisal zikne ira, they take him to the elders of the city. V'loshar makoimoy. V'omruul zikne ira, and they say to the elders of the city, b'neinu zeh soiru rumeira, our son is wayward, he's a rebellious. Enenu shomea, because he does not listen to us. Zoylel v'soiva, he's being indulgent, he's being gluttonous, and he's eating huge amounts of meat and wine and so on. So the pasuk says, interestingly enough, Urugamu kol ansha iroi ba'avonim. People of the city should stone him to death. And eradicate evil. V'chol Yisrael yishmu v'yo, and everyone should listen. Everyone should take a lesson. Now, before we go any further, the Gemara says a very fascinating thing. The Gemara says that this thing never happened. Now, before we talk about it never happening, let's understand what it is, first of all, right? On the surface, this is a halacha that he's saying the following, that, and it's talking about a 13-year-old child, according to the Gemara, the way the Gemara interprets, who's out of control, stealing meat and wine and so on and so forth, and won't listen and won't be warned and won't take a lesson, and he ends up with a capital punishment. Right, that's on the surface. Now, capital punishment exists in the Torah, really, but it exists for capital offenses like murder, adultery, things like that, right? At the end of the day, this kid is just eating a lot of meat and drinking a lot of wine, maybe stealing a little bit, but that's not a capital offense in the Torah, right? So what does the Torah say? So the Gemara says a very fascinating thing. The Gemara says, because Nidoin al shem soifay. This child is judged by what's going to happen to him. Not what happened to him, but what's going to happen to him. Because he's on the path which seems like a path of no return. It's only going to get worse. He's stealing meat and he's drinking wine and he's doing all kinds of things, and then he will have to feed his habit and his addictions, and therefore he's going to continue to steal and eventually end up murdering someone. So why do you have to wait until he ends up murdering an innocent person? Kill him now, so he won't do it, right? That's what it says. Okay, which of course is a very strange thing. We never have that in the Torah ever. The Torah has a system of justice, has a system of reward and punishment, and we have certain transgressions which are extremely severe, for which the Torah does say that there's a possibility of a capital punishment, but never do we have such a concept that if it looks like a person is going to do an Avera, he should be punished. He didn't do it yet. Can't judge someone. I mean, even in modern day justice, you can't punish someone for something they didn't do, right? Question number one. Question number two is, the Gemara says, as I said before, that actually, if you understand this halacha properly, it's statistically impossible to happen. And that's because the Gemara goes into a whole interpretation of this paragraph, that there are many, many conditions that have to be met in order for this to happen. It's only a certain window. It's like only when it becomes bar mitzvah for 3 months or something. The parents have to sound the same. They have to be the same height. There's lots of different conditions that have to be met in order for this to happen. And therefore the Gemara says it's actually statistically impossible to happen. And according to the Gemara, lahoya v'lo nivra, it never happened, never will happen. Lahoya v'lo yivra, never happened, and never will happen. Statistically impossible. So the obvious question is, well, why is it such a mitzvah then, if it can't happen? Says the Gemara, so why did the Torah write this paragraph? If it can't happen anyways, first of all, we don't understand that the halacha. Why would you judge someone according to their end for something they didn't do yet? And second of all, if it can't really happen, it's statistically impossible to happen, so why write it all together? And the Gemara says, the reason that it's written is Yagdol Torah v'yadim, just to enlarge and make the Torah great, meaning have more to learn, kind of thing. That's a simple understanding, right? So in theory, this is the will of Hashem. In practice, it can't happen. But we learn about it, and there's a whole section of the Talmud where we talk about it, and we analyze it, and we learn about it. Yagdil Torah, let the Torah become big and glorious, meaning the more Torah we have, the better, right? That's what it seems to be saying. So the whole thing is very strange. So once saw a pshat like this, that actually no, this is a whole different idea. The reason why this paragraph is written is to teach us that there's always hope. Why? The Torah presents a scenario which seems to be about a person who's on a path of no return, passed by the point of no return. It seems to be a child that is so lost that there's no redemption, right? It seems to be a child where the Torah says that you might come to the conclusion that, okay, logic might dictate, well then let's just end it now rather than put other people to death at the same time. So let's just nidah, let's judge him according to the end. So says the Torah, what I do is I'm going to give you this mitzvah and I'm going to set it up in a way where it's statistically impossible to teach you that there's never a point of no return. There's no such thing. It's a scenario that appears to be a point of no return, but you'll never be able to apply the halacha because there's no such thing as a point of no return. It looks like it's a point of no return, but there's no such thing. There's always a possibility of tshuva. Always. And that's what the Gemara means when it says, why is it written? Yagdil Torah v'yardi, to make the Torah greater. Meaning there'll be more Kedusha, more holiness. Because if you believe in someone's ability to return, if you believe in someone's ability to change, to do tshuva and to reconnect, the Torah becomes greater. The mitzvahs become greater. That's what it means. So the very mitzvah, which seems to be very harsh, actually is the opposite way around. It's actually telling us that such a scenario cannot happen. Why? To teach us that there's no such thing. No such thing. So there's a Rav, his name is Amunasi Techo, the Sefer, he says this. And by this he explains a very fascinating piece of that Gemara. Because, I've forgotten who it was in the Gemara, but the Gemara says this can't happen, right? And then you have a dissenting opinion, it seems like. You have another opinion there in the Gemara that says, no, what do you mean it can't happen? It could happen. He says, I sat on the grave of one of these rebellious sons. So he says. So obviously it could happen. So this Sefer asks the question, what do you mean? I mean, it either happened or didn't happen. You can't have a dispute like an effect. You can have a dispute what the halacha is about something, but you can't, I mean, it either happened or didn't happen. So then if he says he sat on the grave of one of these people that was put to death and he was there by the grave, right? So then it did happen. So then the first opinion should retract. I mean, obviously it did happen, right? So he says, no, that's not the pshat. And he says also, what does it mean? What kind of thing? I sat at the grave. Why would you go? Why would you go sit at a grave of a rebellious son? What would you do that for? You could say, I know about it. I remember the funeral, or I remember he was put to death, or I remember such a thing, or I was there, or I saw it. What do you mean? I sat at the grave. What is that supposed to mean? He says, no. You have to misunderstand the whole Gemara. Then Sari Gemara cannot happen. The second opinion is not arguing; he's proving the point. He's saying, you know, you're right because I remember, or I know about, there was such a son. And of course, it didn't happen. They didn't put him to death. And he ended up becoming a tzaddik. He ended up returning and becoming a really good person, becoming a tzaddik. So much so that I visited his grave, as one does. One visits the grave of a tzaddik. Who used to be a rebellious son. Because there's always hope. So he was proving the point of the first opinion, not arguing. Okay. That's just something from the parsha that is so connected to the idea of the time that we're in. In general, the Mefarshim talk about all the parshas that we read during the month of Elul all have strong connection to Rosh Hashanah and to Elul and the whole thing. Now, before you close your chumash, just go. You know, we're in Elul. Elul is a special time. And the word Elul has so many different interpretations and meanings. I'm going to show you one of them, which is very interesting. Go to Parsha Shlach, which is and I'll show you why I'm learning with you Parsha Shlach in a minute. So it's page 798. It's the story of the spies, right? Yeah, you see it there, top of the page, 798. Says the Chumash, Vayedaber Hashem Moshe Leimer, Hashem spoke to Moshe. Shlach Elcho Anoshim. Send men, send people. The Yosuru Es Eretz Canaan, they will explore, they will spy the land of Canaan, right? Which I'm giving to the Jewish people, one person per tribe, and so on and so forth. Now, you know, so you see the word, the last word, on the, let them spy out the land, which is viyosuru. Viyosuru, right? That's an expression of spying out, exploration, looking into. But now on the side of the Chumash, there's something called Targum Unkelus, right? The translation of the Unkelus, the Aramaic translation of the Torah. If you look at the Hebrew, right on the left of the Hebrew, you see the small Hebrew? It's Unkelus. What is Unkelus? Unkelus is an Aramaic translation of the Chumash, right? But not just the translation, it was written by a very, very great person. Unkelus was actually a convert. Unkelus was a whole story, fascinating story. Unkelus was a Roman nephew, he was a nephew of Roman, a Roman emperor or something. And somehow he found his way to Yiddishkeit and he rejected everything else and became a Jew. He became a very, very great Jew, became one of the great Tanoim. And it's the whole story about the mezuzah, a famous story where the emperor tried to send soldiers to bring him back, and he convinced them, and they converted, and then he sent another group, and he says, don't talk to them, don't talk to him, and then on the way out, he kissed the mezuzah and asked what it is, and explained that in our religion, Hashem protects us, we don't need, in other words, Hashem doesn't have gods around his palace like other kings, on the contrary, he's actually protecting us, and God, anyway, at the end, he couldn't be swayed back, and he became one of the great tzaddikim. And he wrote a translation on the Chumash. And we are taught that the translation that he wrote was written not just as a translation like an article Chumash, it was written with Ruach, written by divine inspiration. So the wording, the nuances in the Targum are very exact and very important and very significant. So let's have a look at if you look at the little small writing on the left over here, the way he translates the word V'yosuru. So it says, Umalil, just go from the beginning, Umalil Hashem im Moshe lememar, which is Aramaic, Hashem spoke Umalil with Moshe saying, Shlach locha guvrin, send men. Now listen to the next word. He translates the word viyosuru, you should explore, you should spy out, viyalalun. Viyalalun, what does that sound like? Elul. Viyalalun, Aramaic, viyalalun, you should explore, but in Aramaic it's the word elul. Viyalalun yos ara, you should explore the landscape, explore the land. So Rav Avraham Sochatshov, the Hasidic Rebbe says, this is the hint to Elul. That's what we have to do in Elul. Elul, we have to dig deep into ourselves. It's called the Chodesh HaCheshbon. It's the month of reckoning. It's the month of reflection, the month of stocktaking. It's a month where we have to spy out. We have to explore. We have to go deep into ourselves, into our consciousness, into our personality, into our strengths and weaknesses, and really sort ourselves out and actually decide where are we up to, where we should be, where we're going, and what could we improve on in the coming year. I just want to share that with you. It's a very beautiful idea. Self-reflection. Reminds me of a little story. In the city of Lubavitch, there was one of the great rebbes was the Rebbe Rashab, one of the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe. And like in many Hasidic courts, Hasidim would come very often for Rosh Hashanah and Kippur to the Rebbe. That was considered the best time to be inspired and to spend these great holy days, etc., etc. There was one particular Yid who couldn't come to the Rebbe for Rosh Hashanah and Kippur because he was a chazan in the shul, right? So in his town, he was the chazan in the shul, so he couldn't leave the post. What he used to do is he would come during Elul and spend a few days in Elul by the Rebbe so to be inspired and so on and so forth. One time he came there and he left quite early. It was still quite a bit of time to Rosh Hashanah, and he came to say goodbye to the Rebbe. So the Rebbe says, I understand you have to go back to Rosh Hashanah, but why are you leaving so early? So he told the Rebbe, he says, I've got to get back home because he said in Yiddish, Medaf Iber Kukin the Machzer. I have to look over the Machzer in preparation for my leading the services. In Yiddish, it's Iber Kukin, you have to look over the Machzer. So the Rebbe Rashab turned to him and said, you make the mistake, Medaf Zich Iber Kukin. Don't worry so much about looking over the machzor, you have to worry about looking over yourself. And for that, you're probably better off staying here for a while. Right? So that was the same idea. It was a time that we have to dig deep into ourselves. Okay. So that process, and coming up to Rosh Hashanah, I wanted to talk about a theme, which is an interesting discussion about Rosh Hashanah. I You came a couple minutes later. I'm giving a shiur on Rosh Hashanah today because the next 2 weeks I'm not going to be here. So I'm traveling overseas for a week for a wedding. I'll come back just before Rosh Hashanah, Mirtz Hashem. So Rabbi Levi will be the next 2 weeks. So I'll do a little bit on Rosh Hashanah. I always do something before Rosh Hashanah or Rosh Hashanah, so we'll do it today. It's Elul already, so it's fine. So when we talk about Rosh Hashanah and Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur for that matter, there's an interesting almost paradox that arises, which we need to explore and understand, right? Almost like a contradiction of themes which we find coming up, right? And it centers around, what is Rosh Hashanah? Is it a happy day? It's not a happy day. It centers around the concept of simcha, joy around Rosh Hashanah, right? Why? On the one hand, right, we look into the Siddur and the Machzor and we see, and also we know, what is Rosh Hashanah? It's a day of judgment, it's a day of tshuva. Tshuva is sometimes a very serious process, right? Tshuva can be a very painful process in a way, a confronting process, right? We read in the Machzor, for example, I mean, we call Rosh Hashanah, what do they call? They're called Yomim Noroim, days of awe, right? Days of awe. Doesn't sound like a Purim, right? Days of awe, yeah? Well, there's a famous piyut, a famous piece that we say on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur called Unasana Toikev, right? Unasana Toikev, where we describe what is happening in the upper worlds on this day. And over there we say a sentence, we say that there's a shofar blowing and the malachim are trembling. And it says, V'chil ura'odo yoichezun, trepidation and shaking takes hold of them, right? Sounds like a scary day in a way, right? The shofar, what's the shofar? The shofar, we say, is a cry. It's a cry coming from it, like a cry of a child. A child who wants to return, right? Doesn't sound like dancing at a wedding. It sounds like, that kind of thing. Okay. And there is a pasuk. It's a famous pasuk which says, Ivdu es Hashem b'simcha. We have to serve Hashem with joy, but it also says sometimes, there's an expression in the pasuk that says, V'gilu biru'odo. Rejoice, but with trembling. It's like sort of a much more reserved joy. Yes, it's a joy, but it's like hidden in a way, right? Which often is applied to Rosh Hashanah, that yes, of course, it's Adir Simcha, but it needs to be much more solemn, much more, right? So there's a very big seriousness, almost a crying, awesomeness, I guess, which is connected to the idea of Rosh Hashanah, right? On the other hand, we actually find a very strong component of simcha, of joy, which you need to understand how it works together. Like, for example, so there's a story, a famous story in Tanakh, where it was the second Beis HaMikdash. What happened was, just to give you the context, Ezra, the great leader Ezra, took the Jews, Ezra and Nehemiah, they took the Jews back after the Babylonian exile. They took the Jews back to Babylon. Now, what happened was, the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. It was destroyed 70 years before the second one was built, because the whole Babylonian exile was supposed to be for 70 years. And the Yidden went into Golus, they went into exile in Babylon. But there was still a community of Jews in Israel, right? Eventually, 70 years later, when the Jews returned to Israel to rebuild the temple, rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, they found the community there. And in fact, Ezra took the Jews back from Babel, but not all the Jews came back, which was a story in its own right. It was a bit of a criticism of the Jewish people then. That they had the opportunity to go back to Israel and build the Beis HaMikdash, and they didn't. A lot of them. So there was still remained a very big community in Babylon or Persia at that time. And they took back some communities, and there was a community in Israel. The problem was the community in Israel had become very distant from Yiddishkeit. And there's a story in Tanakh where Ezra, on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, gathers the people, right? And he inspires them and he awakens them to tshuva. And he says they have to reconnect to the Torah, right? And it works. The drasha works. And what happens? They start to cry. They start to yearn. Right? So you'd think that Ezra would be really happy, right? It worked. The drasha worked. How many times can you say you give a drasha and it really works? It stirs people, right? So it worked. And then he turns around to him and says, No, you're making a mistake. He says, and now, Al te'otsu, do not be sad. He tells them, go home. This is what it says in the Tanakh. He says, go home. Ichlu mashmanim, eat fatty foods. Go have a lamb chop, right? Shatu mamtakim, drink sweet things. Ki kodosh hayoyim ladineinu, because it's a holy day. Rejoice. Send presents to those who don't have. He says, ki chedvas Hashem, because the hope and the joy of God, hi ma'uschem, is your strength. He told him, you must not be depressed. You must not be sad. You must go home and rejoice. Right? Different to what we described before. There's also a famous medrash which is quoted in the Shulchan Aruch by the Tur. And the Tur says like this, about Erev Rosh Hashanah, an amazing idea. An amazing medrash, beautiful medrash, right? The Tur says like this, that Erev Rosh Hashanah, what happens to the Jewish people in Erev, the day before Rosh Hashanah? So the Tur says, brings a medrash like this, that the way of the world is, that if someone is facing a very, very serious court case, they're down, they're scared, they use the language of the medrash, loifshim shachori, they put on black clothes. They're not in a good space. Everything's at stake. They're facing a terrible time, right? They're facing a really, really hard thing. But says the medrash, the Torah brings it down, the Jewish people are different. Erev Rosh Hashanah, the day before, the day which we call in the Siddur Yom Hadin, the day of judgment. Loishim levonim, mistaprim, he says, they go to the bathhouses, look, they take a haircut, they take a good shower. Loishim levonim, they put on beautiful clothes. Loishim levonim, they wrap themselves with beautiful things. And they trust in Hashem that everything's going to be okay. They have bitochen. They believe, they rely on Hashem, right? Which is an amazing thing, right? Sometimes we rely on Hashem that something else will happen. But here we're relying on Hashem, He's the one judging us, but we're lying, it's all going to be good. In other words, there's that air of Yontif in the air, and it is, right? At the end of the day, Rosh Hashanah, we have Yontif meals, correct? We have Yontif meals, we eat fish, we eat filter fish, we drink wine, we eat meat, whatever. It's the Yontif meals we have, right? We have guests, all kinds of things, yeah? So what's going on here? What is these two themes? How do they come together, right? And of course, I mean, there is a seriousness to Rosh Hashanah and Kippur. I mean, Rosh Hashanah and Kippur is not like Sukkot or Simchas Torah. It's different. It is different. But if you tell me Rosh Hashanah and Kippur is very serious and Sukkot is to rejoice, I understand. But Rosh Hashanah, it has both. So we need to understand how it all comes together. I'm going to share with you a couple of ideas around this theme. So first of all, before we blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah, which shofar is like the main mitzvah of Rosh Hashanah and so on, right? We say a bunch of different verses from the Torah, right? From Tilim and things like that. One of the psukim we say, a famous pasuk, we say, Min hametzar karosika, I call to Hashem from narrowness, like narrowness from constrictedness. Ononi bamerchavko, He answers me from an abundance, from a broadness, right? Which the Mefarshim say is actually hinted in the shofar itself. The way shofar is blown is you blow from the narrow side. And the sound comes up from the wide side, right? What does that mean? It means like this. These two things, the narrowness, the small hole at the beginning of the shofar, the big hole, the wide hole at the end of the shofar, are these two themes of Rosh Hashanah. The seriousness, the pain, the discomfort, the awesomeness, and the joy. What does that mean? So here's a very, very fundamental concept. Of course, Rosh Hashanah is a day of tshuva. Of course, it's a serious day. However, in Yiddishkeit, there's a very fundamental principle, and it goes like this. In Yiddishkeit, when we confront our shortcomings, when we confront our weaknesses, right, which is what Elul is about, we're supposed to reflect, and confronting our weaknesses is not an easy thing to do, it's a confronting thing to do, and it sometimes makes us uncomfortable, and it should, because that's how growth works, right? Growth works by being uncomfortable. You don't grow unless you're uncomfortable where you are, right? Anyone who's complacent doesn't grow because it's good now. Why do I have to go into anything else? So the only way I can grow is when I'm not comfortable where I am now. And that comes, that's born out of the tshuva process where we have regret about the past and we think about, no, I shouldn't be, I should really be progressing, I should really be improving, right? That's true. So a real cheshbon, a real reflection, a real honest look at ourselves can make us uncomfortable but should never make us sad. That's the difference. In Yiddishkeit, it doesn't make us sad at all. In fact, there's a certain happiness that comes with it. Why? Because let's understand how it works, right? It works like this. Yes, we look at the year gone by. We think to ourselves, you know, I should have been better here. I should have been better here. These are the things I need to fix and so on and so forth, right? So yeah, it creates a discomfort. It creates a certain amount of healthy guilt, right? Healthy guilt means I, for a short period of time, I feel very uncomfortable when I commit and I resolve to come back, which is the cry of the shofar, right? That's what it represents. I feel distant from Hashem because I messed up throughout the year. That's what it is. And that distance then gives birth to that cry of the child saying, I want to come back. I want to reconnect. But it comes also with tremendous simcha because when we have that cry, when we feel that distance, and we want to reconnect, it comes together with the knowledge that Hashem always welcomes us back. That Hashem gives us that opportunity. That process of feeling uncomfortable about the things we've done perhaps wrong and the things we need to improve on is not a negative process, it's a gift. It's an amazing gift that Hashem gave us. Hashem wouldn't ask us to be uncomfortable about the past if we couldn't fix it. The whole reason He asks us to do that is because we can fix it. And not only fix it, we can bounce back even stronger than before. We can become closer to Hashem even than before. That's the whole idea of tshuva. Tshuva means tshuva brings a person to a level of connection with Hashem that you cannot achieve without distance. That's that deep yearning that comes only from distance. Right? That's not a recommendation to sin, by the way. It's just that's the fact. We all have our weaknesses and we all have our distances from Hashem. And it's that distance that facilitates a very deep yearning to reconnect, and it creates a deeper connection than we have before. That's why the Gemara says that someone who does tshuva is higher than a tzaddik. A tzaddik has always done the right thing. Well, if you've done the right thing, you've always been close. You've never experienced yearning. You've never experienced distance. But someone who's been distant and reconnects, it's even greater. Right? So that knowledge that Hashem has designed this process and He's given us that gift called tshuva, yes, it has a certain amount of pain with that process. It's difficult, right? It is difficult. It's confronting, and it's hard work, and it's something that we're supposed to do during Elul, and parts of it will be uncomfortable, but also has to come with tremendous simcha, knowing that, yes, uncomfortable because Hashem has given me the opportunity to identify the areas that I need to improve and to give me the opportunity to fix it and to come back. And no matter how many times I made the mistake, He'll always welcome me back. There's an expression in the Amidah that we say every day, right? Every day we ask Hashem for forgiveness. So we say, in the bracha, we ask Hashem to forgive us. It says, we end the bracha by saying, Baruch Atah Hashem, Chanun HaMarbe Lisloyach. Hashem is the merciful one who abundantly forgives. What does it mean to abundantly forgive? So the Alter Rebbe explains to Tani very simply. He says, this is what it means. A person of flesh and blood might also forgive the first time you hurt them, the second time you hurt them, the third time maybe, but after a few times, told to get lost. Not interested anymore. Hashem doesn't do that. Hashem, HaMarbeli, He abundantly forgives. Doesn't matter how many times you come back. It's always there for you. Always forgives. Always welcomes you back. Right? So that's the two, that's the two parts of the shofar. Of course the shofar has meitzar, a feeling of constrictedness. And yes, it's their judgment and we need to reconnect and so on and so forth. Of course. But that process breeds the broadness of the end of the shofar, the tremendous simcha, the tremendous bracha, the tremendous gift. And yes, and that's why the two things have to work together, Rosh Hashanah. Of course it's Yom HaDin, of course it's awesome days, and of course there's a certain amount of tremor and trembling in the heavens and so on and so forth. But the Torah says we still get dressed every Rosh Hashanah because we know what kind of gift it is. We know what kind of simcha it is to be able to do that. We go through the process, but we know Hashem will for sure accept us. And we know that Hashem will for sure welcome us back. And that's why we're confident. And that's why we treat it as a yontif. And that's why Ezra told the Jewish people, go home. Yeah, he brought them to tshuva. He stirred them. But he says, now go home and rejoice. Because your tshuva is going to be accepted. So Hashem will connect with you. And that's why eat food and rejoice. And that hope, that trust in Hashem, that is the strength. That is the strength of the day. So the two things are not contradictory to each other at all. Just say a little story. The Ben Ish Chai. The Ben Ish Chai was a very great Sephardic sage. Who died in 1902, not so long ago, relatively speaking. He was the Rav of a very, very large kehillah in Baghdad, Iraq. Right? And he had a custom that he would blow the shofar in his shul, every Rosh Hashanah. But before he blew the shofar, he would leave the shul and go into a room to prepare. Shofar is a very special time. And sometimes they would overhear him crying and doing tshuva and really, you know. One time, after he was in his room, he came out. And instead of blowing the shofar, he started to give like a little shir. He started to speak. And he said the following, he says. He said, before you blow shofar, of course you have to understand what shofar is. It's that cry of return, right? And also it's a call to improve. In fact, the word shofar comes to the word shippur, to beautify, to improve our ways and so on. And then he said this idea that the shofar is narrow on the one side and broad on the other side. He says, why? Because it's got to start off with a push. It's got to start off with feeling a kvetch a little bit, right? And then he said the most amazing thing. He said, this is typical of him in the way he would teach things. He said like this. The word shofar is shin vav pei resh, right? Shin vav pei resh. You got to look at the letters before the shofar letters and the letters after the shofar letters. So the letters before shofar, right, which is a resh, a hey, an ayin, and a kuf. Those are right, you know, before shin is a resh, right before. So if you look at the word, the four letters of the shofar, and you take in the alphabet, the four letters that come before those four letters, it spells the word. If you change the letters around, akara. Akara means a barren woman, a woman who can't give birth to children, right? Empty. She doesn't have children. In other words, a person comes to the shofar. Before the shofar, you have to build up that sense of I'm far, I'm empty. And if I want to come back, that's why you brought the shofar, that cry from that small hole. But if you go through that process, what's the end of the shofar? What's the letters after the shofar? Letters after the shofar is Tof Zayim Tzadik Shin, which don't make a word, but they have a gematria. He said, what's the numerical value of the four letters after the shofar? It's a pasuk, Sarcha Harbe Ma'oid. Your reward is great. It's what Hashem told Avram Avinu. Your reward is great. Sarcha Harbe Ma'oid. So that's the shofar at the beginning, the small hole and the big hole. Yes, you start off with a feeling of akara, I'm barren, I'm empty. But when you cry out to Hashem, you connect. And Hashem accepts it without a doubt. And the end of the shofar, which meaning letters after the shofar, is the gematria of Scharcha Harbe Me'oyed, your reward is great. Very beautiful idea. In the same vein, I'm going to share a couple of things on the same sort of line, right? So, there was a very famous Hasidic Rebbe called Reb Tzodek HaKoyen from Lublin. And he says the following, same idea, he says beautiful. He says, we know that a number of times in Tanakh we have the word Hayoyim, the day. And we always think to say that the day refers to Rosh Hashanah. I'll give you an example, like, the last parasha we read before Rosh Hashanah, right, in 2 weeks' time, is Nitzovim. That's the parasha we read always before Rosh Hashanah. And it's Moshe Rabbeinu talking to the Jews before they're going out of Egypt, before they're going into Israel, I mean. And he says to them, Atem Nitzovim Hayoim Kulchem, you are standing today, all of you together. And we always read before Rosh Hashanah because in a different way, that Hayoim actually refers to Rosh Hashanah. And Hashem is telling us, you're all standing before Rosh Hashanah today. You have to prepare, there's a blessing, and so on and so forth. So, whenever we say the word Hayoim, we say it refers to Rosh Hashanah. Where does that come from? Why should the word Hayoim mean Rosh Hashanah? So, it comes from a Zohar. Okay? And the Zohar comments on a pasuk in the book of Job, Iyov. Right? In the book of Iyov, there's a story, and the story begins with Vayehi Hayoim, and it was that day. Vayehi Hayoim, it was on that day. The Zohar says, what day are we talking about? The Zohar says, the day means Rosh Hashanah. That's the day. Okay. Now, when we say the word day, what does that represent? Day represents clarity, light. Yeah? Which we know at the very beginning of Bereshit, the very beginning of the Torah, it says Hashem called, he called Oyer, what did he call the light? Yoy, he called the day. What do you call it? Darkness? Light. They call it night. But day means oil, light, clarity, right? Okay. So then, Reb Tzodek HaKoyen asks the following question. Before I ask the question, it fits into another thing. You know, there's a chapter of Tehillim we say during Elul, chapter 27, the Dovid Hashem Oiri, right? It says, Hashem is my light and my salvation. And one of the reasons we say that is because the Medrash says that light refers to Rosh Hashanah. So why is light refer to Rosh Hashanah? Same idea, because Rosh Hashanah is called Yoim, day. Day is clarity, day is light. So light means Rosh Hashanah. In other words, Rosh Hashanah is a day of tremendous clarity. It's a day of brightness, it's a day of blessing, it's a day of where we reach a clarity of our values, of our connection to Hashem, and so on and so forth. So Tzadok HaKohen asks the question, let's go back to this whole thing where it's based. It's based on the Pasuk in Iyot, where the Pasuk says, Vayihi HaYoim, it happened that day. And the Zohar says that that day is referring to Rosh Hashanah. And we just said, why is it called the day? Because the day of clarity, that's a problem. Why? Because it starts with Vayihi HaYoim, and it was that day. We have a Gemara that tells us that every time it says the word Vayihi, right, there's two words, Vayihi and Vehoya. Vayihi means that it was, Vehoya means that it will be. Says the Gemara, most times it says the word Vayihi, it always spells trouble, pain. It's always pain. Like, for example, the beginning of the story of Purim, it says, Vayihi b'meach days of Achashverosh, and a Haman pops up, right? Vayihi means pain. Vehoya means joy. But Vayihi means pain. She says, how does this work together? Vayihi hayoim. Yoim is Rosh Hashanah. It was that day, Rosh Hashanah. Vayihi means pain. So how do those two things go together? How does clarity and brightness come together with pain? And he says, that's exactly the pshat, just what we've been saying. He says, that's the idea. The idea is that the clarity is born out of the pain. The clarity and the brightness and the greatness of Rosh Hashanah is born out of, I'm uncomfortable with where I am. I feel a distance between me and Hashem because I've worked the whole Elul to create that cheshbon, and that creates the clarity. Like the two sides of the shofar. In other words, that clarity of Rosh Hashanah, the brightness, the greatness, the warmth, the daytime of Rosh Hashanah comes from the Vayihi. It comes from the feeling of, I'm very in pain. So what am I going to do about it now? Come here. Yeah, you have a look around. No problem at all. Same idea. You follow the same sort of thing. And that's why he says, there's a concept why Rosh Hashanah is called Rosh Hashanah. Because there's a Gemara that says like this, that Shana Sherosha Bitchilasa Bisasheres Pesoifa. That any day that starts, that any year it says that starts off like poor, will end up wealthy. What does that mean? Same idea. You know, any year that starts off that feeling of constrictedness, that feeling of it's not good the way it is, ends up good, ends up great. In other words, that's why the whole the process of tshuva is a good process, a healthy process, and it's a process of joy. No problem. If I see it, I'll contact you.
Thank you.
No problem. Right? It's the same idea. It's that same idea of Vayihi Hayoim, and it was that day. Vayihi is a pain, is an expression of pain. Hayoim, expression of brightness. Those two themes of Rosh Hashanah coming together. It's the greatness and the brightness coming out of the discomfort, knowing that. If we just want to reconnect, Hashem is right there for us. And finally, this idea is also brought out beautifully in one of the writings of the Shar Yisachar, which is the Munkacher Rebbe. He says like this. There's a pasuk which I mentioned before. It says, "Ivdu es Hashem beYira." Serve Hashem with fear, or right. The gilu and rejoice, be ra'odah, rejoice even when you're trembling. So the way it's normally understood is what I said before. That when you have a time of joy, but it's reserved joy. He says the other way around. He says, what the pasuk really means is, according to the Gemara Yerushalmi, it says when it comes the day of the Jerusalem Talmud says like this, that what it means is that when it comes a day of troubling, you should rejoice. He says, what do you mean? He says, that's exactly the point. And he mentions a very interesting thing. He says, Rosh Hashanah is a day of awe, right? And Yom Kippur too, but you know, we found a funny thing. A lot of those pieces of the Machsav, which we talk about, and we talk about how awesome the day is. Even on Yom Kippur we do vidu, we confess, right? And we go through a long list of shortcomings that we might have, and why we mistreated people, and we didn't. We weren't always honest, and we did this, and we did that, and who knows, right? It's a pretty confronting piece, right? Okay, the good part is we say it in the plural, so we include all of us. So we all say the same thing, so maybe it's a little bit easier. But still, if we take it seriously, And how do we, right? And it's like a long, and then it starts off with the word Ashamnu. Ashamnu means I'm guilty, I rebel, we rebelled, we spoke badly, right? How's that said in Shul on Yom Kippur? It's said with a sing song. Have you noticed that? Ashamnu, Bogadnu. Which nachkes does that? I mean, like, if you're serious about it, like, are you serious? You're not serious. If you're really serious about, you think you might have stolen and spoken Lashon Hara and fooled other people and been deceitful and who knows what, you sing? Right? What kind of song is that? You're crying, not sing. And that's it. That's what he says. He says that even in a time of pain, you have to sing. But that's the point, because that's Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, yes, there is a certain trembling that we talk about in the Machzor. But at the same time, we sing it. Because you'll never get through this process of tshuva, he says, with sadness. That feeling of discomfort has to be done with joy. The joy in the knowledge that, yes, it's okay to fail. You did fail and you feel uncomfortable about it, and that's fine. And so you should, because then you'll grow. But that process has to be with confidence, has to be with joy, has to be with happiness. That's with the knowledge that Hashem is allowing you to reconnect. He's giving you an opening to come back. And that's how those two things get together. All right? So those are the two themes of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. What happens afterwards is that once we go through that process and Hashem, we know, has accepted our tshuva, then comes Sukkot, which is just a full-blown celebration. It's a full-blown celebration of the reconnection. But even the first part of the journey, which is the hard part, also has to be with joy. And that's how those two themes come together on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Okay, we'll stop there.